You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
It's time for Atomic Show number 132. And man, it's been a long time since I got around to podcasting. It's been a busy, busy month. My wife and I had the opportunity to take a wonderful vacation out to the areas of Utah where there's canyons and mountains and deserts and completely different than my East Coast normal living. Saw beautiful scenery, refreshed my brain, got a lot of hikes in. It was a great time. But that took a big chunk out of the last month, and then when I got back to work, wow, it's almost impossible to go away for a nice week-long vacation and then have to come back during a busy time of the budget seasons and whatnot. So I've been working late hours, haven't had any energy when I got home, and so you folks, well, maybe you suffer, maybe you don't. Maybe you prefer when there's not too many shows coming on. But several of you have asked, where's the Atomic Show? So I'm back. It's been an interesting time for the nuclear industry. Like all clean energy businesses, there have been a lot of folks that have been spending a lot of time in Washington trying to convince legislators to frame legislation in one way or another to support or provide assistance or just simply to enable their technology to move forward. Wind and solar industries have been knocking on many doors. The coal, oil, and gas industry has spent they spent about $50 million in the last quarter trying to sway energy legislation to be favorable to them. And, of course, the nuclear industry is quietly working to make sure that people remember that if you're really concerned about clean energy, you've got to at least consider nuclear in the mix. You've got to consider the fact that fission does not release gases, does not release carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxides, or any fly ash particulates. It also prevents mercury from entering the environment, which is often sourced from coal-fired power plants. And it is scalable. It's something that has proven its ability to displace coal, oil, and natural gas. And I think that may be one of the reasons why it's not been all that popular, because those folks have the ability to persuade others that there's a tiger in your tank or other silly advertising slogans that have been developed over the years. They certainly have a strong effort going these days to convince everyone that natural gas is clean and almost unlimited. We've got that shale gas. It can shale gas takes a lot of effort. You got to drill really deep, you got to crack up a bunch of shale, and the wells go dry pretty quickly. They deplete at a rate about twice as fast as most natural gas deposits, so you got to keep drilling lots of holes in the ground to keep the shale gas flowing. Today's show is going to be mostly consisting of an interview that I recently did with a documentary filmmaker who is going around collecting stories from both pro and anti-nuclear activists. The guy's name is Ray Squirrel, and he's got a YouTube page, which I'll provide links to. Recently, he sat down and spent an hour or so talking with Carl Grossman, who has been a longtime anti-nuclear activist on the college lecture circuit since he wrote a book in the 1970s about Three Mile Island. He was a journalist in for the New York Times and decided that he was going to make a profession out of bashing the nuclear industry. And he's done pretty well for himself over the years. Here is the interview, and I'm going to try to just clip out the parts that aren't terribly interesting. Ray's kind of a background guy. He's making the film. The person who's talking to me is James, and James and I spoke for a good long time about a large number of topics. Before I get to the interview, I want to give out a call to action. This week, starting May 18th, is going to be an important week for people who are very interested in the long-term development of clean energy, clean, reliable energy that really gives us the opportunity to change our dependence on fossil fuel. Anybody who's listened to the Atomic Show or has read the Atomic Insights blog knows that I'm pretty skeptical about what most people call renewable energy. Wind, solar, biofuels are all weather-dependent sources that don't give humans the reliable energy that they need, and they also make a huge impact on the natural environment that I love to protect. The idea of carpeting vast areas of the desert, like the places that I spent time hiking in the last month or so, just frosts me. The idea of putting windmills on mountain ridges, deciding that we're going to use all of the resources of North Dakota to cover with windmills and build transmission lines to the rest of the country just seems like an absurd vision and one that is a nightmare to me. I also don't like the idea of cutting down forests to burn the fuels that are there or to plant crops. Not only has the biofuels industry added a lot of volatility to food markets, they've done a tremendous amount of environmental damage in Brazil and in the South Pacific. It's just incredible to me to think that people think we can grow in today's world enough energy to replace all of the concentrated energy that was built up over millions of years and has come to us in the form of coal, oil, and natural gas. So my call to you is to make sure that you talk to your representatives, your senators, and tell them that you want clean, reliable energy and that you do not want a system that excludes the best source of clean, reliable energy. You want a system that enables the long-term investments into expensive but reliable nuclear power plants that can provide emission-free energy for decades, as proven by the performance of our existing fleet of reactors. Remember, the people who are telling you that reactors are terribly expensive said the same thing about the very inexpensive electricity sources that we have operating on our grid today. People like Amory Lovins and Carl Grossman and Harvey Wasserman often talk about how expensive the future nuclear power plants are going to be and wave their hands when you bring up data about how inexpensive the current generation are. But remember, they told us that those plants were going to be terribly expensive as well. They emphasized the cost overruns and the incredible amount of resources going into building new nuclear power plants in the 1970s, yet once we finished those plants and began operating them, they did exactly what some of the early promoters said they were going to do. They provide electricity that is almost too cheap to meter. One could sell the electricity by the month. There's no real reason to count exactly how much one uses as long as you know how large a capacity is going into a particular customer's location. You could do it just like charging for cell phones. You get a flat monthly rate, and you use as much as you need. The power plant's there, the people have to work whether the plant is operating or not, and the fuel is pretty cheap at about half a cent per kilowatt hour, much cheaper than even, quote, cheap coal, and far cheaper than natural gas. Here's my interview with the documentary filmmaker, and I'll talk to you at the end of the show.
I guess we're ready to go. Mr. Adams, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I just looked on your blog. You call yourself an atomic entrepreneur. I'm just wondering if you'd be able to just elaborate a little bit on that.
Sure. 1991, I started doing some work in classes, and by 1993, I'd left my job as a naval officer and started up a company called Adams Atomic Engines. My goal was to design and build small nuclear power plants based on a closed-cycle gas turbine design that was derived out of a German program and also based on the U.S. Army's design called the ML-1, obviously with some refinements on both of those.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, so Adams Atomic Engines worked real hard for about 3 years, and at that point we put it to sleep and decided that we were a little bit ahead of the bleeding edge.
Mm-hmm. A little bit ahead of the bleeding edge, you said?
Yeah, that was 1996. At that point, natural gas prices were about $1.80 per million BTU. Oil prices got close to single digits, and there wasn't much interest in alternatives to fossil fuels at that time.
Mm-hmm. Was the nuclear industry at the time, was this was a rather fallow period? Is that fair to say?
I would say that it was the bottom of the nuclear industry. I went to nuclear industry events at that time, and fully half of the booths were focused on D&D, decommissioning and decontamination.
Mm-hmm. And this was, from what I understand, since 1979, since Three Mile Island, is it true that no new plants have been built, or is that a misunderstanding on my part?
It's not a misunderstanding. The last new plant that has actually been ordered and completed in the United States was ordered in 1973. Now, the last new plant to come online came online in 1996. It took 23 years to build it. That was a TVA plant at Watts Bar 1.
TVA, that stands for what?
Tennessee Valley Authority.
Oh, I see. Okay. And the name of the plant is?
Watts Bar 1.
Watts Bar 1. Okay. And Adams Atomic Engines, your business, is that you – are you still pursuing that, or is that?
Adams Atomic Engines' current products are a blog and a podcast and a couple of websites. We have at various times tried to raise financing, and as a matter of fact, January 2nd of 2008, we were sitting in New York City talking to some investment bankers. They were very interested, but by May, June timeframe of 2008, the world had changed again, so we backed off of our development plans and retained our day job.
Due to the economic situation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Financing anything became almost impossible. I think there's only been like one or two IPOs in the whole country, you know, very little investment banking, particularly in something as far out as small nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm. One argument that I have heard from nuclear opponents is that construction of plants tended to be rather expensive. Is this a fallacy? Is this because of older technology and now we have newer technology that would prove more cost effective?
It all depends on how you build the plants. There were a lot of cost overruns at the end of the first atomic age. But part of that was because the plants were being built at a time when interest rates got as high as 20%. Inflation was running around 15 or 20%. We're talking the late 1970s and the first part of the 1980s. And all mm-hmm. it takes to make a project, especially a very capital-intensive project, become uneconomical is to delay it, especially if you can delay it after a whole bunch of money has been spent and the workers are on site, and every day the clock is ticking, the interest is building up. I think for most of the plants that people talk about with the highest cost overruns, fully two-thirds of the total cost of the plant was in interest expenses.
Interest expenses?
Yep. Borrowing okay. money to build a plant, taking 10 years to build the plant, and the entire time there is no revenue coming in. And the whole time, your interest is simply compounding. A very expensive thing to do.
Here on Long Island, where we had the Shoreham nuclear power plant, which never, to my knowledge, went online, the cost of this was reputed to be in the neighborhood of $6 to $7 billion. I believe construction began sometime in the early 1970s and finished around the mid 1980s. And there was a ratepayer revolt. A lot of the cost was, according to the reports I've read, a lot of the costs were eventually considered just the cost of construction was collected by Lilco, and the rates continued to go up and go up. And I think that was a large part of what the economic argument against nuclear energy actually at that time was, I guess, a large part of what persuaded people here against it. But now that 30 years later, now that things have changed, people are beginning to look at nuclear energy with fresh eyes and listen with fresh ears. Do you find that to be the case?
There is no doubt in the world that the most expensive thing that you can do is to spend 10 or 15 years building a plant and then never operate it. So you never get any product out of it. You never get any revenue to pay the bills. That is, you know, the infinite cost of a kilowatt hour from Shoreham is the most expensive electricity ever produced, because it did finish construction. It did get a federal license, and it was something that probably could have been operated safely, securely, and produced revenue that would have paid off a good bit of that bill instead of buying natural gas to produce the power. Now, on the other hand, Shoreham was also a very expensive plant because of the unique labor situation in Long Island, New York, not just unions, but organized criminal unions. There was an awful lot of involvement with faulty contractors. You know, the same kind of guys that haul trash in your area.
Does the public need is there a lot of misunderstandings on nuclear power, do you find? Does the public need re-education, for lack of a better word, on the issue?
Well, certainly the public needs to have access to information. And some of the information that the public has been told about nuclear power is completely false. One thing that people get told repeatedly about nuclear power is what we just discussed. They say that nuclear power is too expensive. The reality is that over the last 10 or 15 years, the second lowest cost electricity on the grid in the United States has been nuclear. The first lowest cost electricity is hydroelectric, coming from 50-year-old dams. But the nuclear power that's on the grid is what allows people to talk about low-cost overnight power. It's because the nuclear plants are running. The fuel cost for those plants is on the order of about 50 cents per kilowatt. About a half a cent per kilowatt hour compared to natural gas, where the cost is somewhere around, even today, 2.5-3 cents a kilowatt hour. A couple of years ago, got as high as 10 cents a kilowatt hour just for fuel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, nuclear provides reliable, low cost, clean energy, zero emissions. You know, I learned my nuclear trade going to sea on submarines. When you can seal up your power plant inside a small ship filled with people and operate safely for months at a time, that gives you a different view of nuclear compared to what most people have. I think the nuclear industry has not done a very good job of telling its own story. America is a place of commercial communication. It's protected by our First Amendment. The nuclear industry has allowed other people to tell its story and to shape its story in a bad way. And finally, the thing that I think people need to hear most about nuclear power is that it is a competitor to coal, oil, and natural gas. And that's a very important concept for people to understand, that when nuclear power plants come online, they displace coal, oil, or natural gas, generally coal or natural gas. And that doesn't make suppliers of coal and natural gas very happy.
Mm-hmm. How much does it displace the fossil fuels by when they do come online, as you said?
Well, a single nuclear power plant replaces a market for about 4 million tons of coal per year. Well-known rule of thumb in the nuclear industry is that if you have an unplanned shutdown, the replacement power fuel cost is somewhere between $1.5 and $2 million per day.
$1.5 and $2 million per day. Did I hear that correctly?
That's correct. Just to replace the fuel to produce 1,000 megawatts of power.
I realize I'm getting away from this a little bit, but just to get a little more background on you, Mr. Adams, where did your interest in nuclear energy, nuclear technology come from? Were you interested in this at a young age, or did you come to be interested later on?
My father was an electrical engineer for Florida Power and Light Company, and I grew up in South Florida. And when we used to have company picnics, we picnicked under the smokestacks of oil-fired power plants. Florida Power and Light was a kind of unique power company because being in Florida, they didn't burn much coal. Coal's hard to get down there. They burned a lot of oil from Venezuela. And when I was a young child, early 60s, I was probably 5 years old, 6 years old, my father talked to me about these new plants that his company was building at Turkey Point and then later on at St. Lucie. And we talked a lot about the fact that these plants were going to replace having to import oil, that they were going to be much cleaner, better for the Sunshine State. And he did talk to me at the time. He says, you know, one of the things that the engineers, he wasn't a nuclear engineer, he was an electrical engineer, worked on transmission lines. He said one of the things that his friends that were associated with plants were concerned about was what to do with the leftovers. He said he didn't quite understand why they were so worried because it didn't take up much space. It were pretty easy to store. And then he found out that the real reason was that they were so used to just throwing away their waste in the smokestacks that when they were told they had to actually handle the waste, it was just something they were concerned about. How do they do it? They figured it out. I mean, they've never, you know, no nuclear plants ever just, you know, left its waste go to the environment. The nuclear plants keep their waste sealed up, secure, protected, monitored, inventoried, rather than up the smokestack. So, yeah, I started early. And when I was in high school, I told my guidance counselor that I wanted to study nuclear engineering. And he said, well, if you want to study nuclear engineering and you don't mind a free education, one of the best places in the world to learn about nuclear power is in the Navy. And he said, and I got some connections up at the Naval Academy. So let me introduce you to some folks.
That's where it all took off?
And so that's where I went to school. I went to the Naval Academy. I majored in English at the Academy and then convinced Admiral Rickover that I had learned enough in my math and science classes to enter his program. At this point, we started experiencing some Skype connection difficulties. I'll cut back in at the point where our interview restarted. There's a little bit of audio difficulties initially, but it gets better.
I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the interview we did with Carl Grossman, the reporter, but he did mention Admiral Rickover as someone who had been skeptical of nuclear energy at one point. Is that a true statement to your knowledge?
Admiral Rickover made some statements when he was 82 years old after having served for 40-some-odd years as the head of Navy nuclear power. I can't explain the statements that he made at that age. I do have some friends who have described Admiral Rickover as not being in the greatest of health. Those statements were in the last 6 months of his life, and I think it's far more instructive to take a look at his 40-some-odd years' worth of safe operation and design of nuclear power plants, some of the papers that he wrote in the 1950s when he was very prescient about the need to use fission to replace combustion of fossil fuels for important reasons like depletion of fossil fuels and for emissions. He talked about his worries about the buildup of things like carbon dioxide and things like that, you know, way before anybody else was talking about it. So I think that it was kind of, it's a little disingenuous for folks like Grossman to claim that Admiral Rickover was opposed or even really concerned. Now, the one thing about Admiral Rickover that people need to understand is he was a pretty vain guy in terms of believing that he was the man. He was the only one who could do what he did. The program that he set up has run very successfully even though he's not been around since 1982. So it continues to do its job very well.
Mm-hmm. You said that your experience in the Navy taught you to be more accepting of nuclear technology, but you were kind of well on your way with your education and everything else. But did that make kind of the difference? That kind of completed the picture, so to speak.
Well, it's hard to convince somebody who has actually operated a plant and has seen what it takes to what kind of machinery is involved, what kind of piping systems are involved. The thick-walled pressure vessels, the containments, you really have to have an opportunity to have real detailed knowledge. And then you get the opportunity to see how the plant performs in all kinds of different situations. On board submarines, I can tell you that we don't operate baseload power plants. We operate plants that are propulsion plants. They drive a ship around the ocean. They respond to commands, and they don't operate at steady state. They do some amazing things, and the comfort level that one can develop as you build more knowledge and experience in that, it just can't be overcome. It's, you know, let me say it in a sailor's way. Mm-hmm. The sailors will say, "Don't piss on my head and tell me it's raining." And when somebody tells me that nuclear power is inherently dangerous, I say, you don't know what you're talking about. It's not inherently dangerous any more than any other human activity is inherently dangerous.
Mm-hmm. When nuclear opponents make points concerning waste disposal, that seems to be one of the issues that comes up. One of the concerns that kind of translates to normal folks too. Just average citizens. Why is there nothing to fear with the waste disposal process? Exactly how does it work? Are there different methods?
Well, the nuclear opponents talk about the fact that we can't agree on what we're going to do with the waste, that we still haven't come up with a permanent disposal method. And I kind of think that that's like going to Restaurant Row in a good city with good restaurants and saying, man, there's just nothing to eat. I just can't decide what to eat. Okay, there are so many ways to handle safely the used nuclear fuel, the leftovers. One of the best things about nuclear power is that it produces a little bit less waste than the initial fuel that's put into the plant because part of the mass gets converted into energy. But for the most part, the amount of waste is equal to the amount of fuel you put in. And you don't put in very much fuel. In a nuclear plant, instead of 100 train car loads of coal every day, you get 3 truckloads of fuel every 18 months. Every 18 months, you remove one-third of the core, and you put it into either a deep pool of water, which is smaller than the swimming pools I used to swim in when I grew up, although much deeper. Or after the fuel's been sitting in the deep pool of water for a while, you can put it into a dry storage container. For a plant that's designed to last for 60 years, you would need about 120 canisters that would take up the same amount of space as maybe 100 parking spaces. That's not much, considering that, you know, we're talking about a plant that could power 1 million people for 60 years. Now, if you take all the fuel in the U.S. that we have, all the used fuel, and you put it in one place, it would take up less space than a football stadium. Again, that's not much space to devote to safely storing the leftovers. I would prefer to have half a dozen secure locations around the country so we don't have to move this stuff very far. And let it build up. And once there's an inventory, there will be people that say, you know, there's some valuable materials over there. There's still a lot of energy left in that fuel. Let's recycle it. Let's take out the stuff that we don't think can burn and put the stuff that can fission back into a reactor. And there will be people, and I know a few already, who will say, you know, that fission products, there's some stuff in there that's pretty cool. There's There's some rhodium. There's palladium. There's gold. There's silver. There's all kinds of very interesting and useful materials that people are calling waste. They're not accessible right now because we just store the rods whole. But if we start chemically reprocessing, those fission products may become a valuable revenue stream.
Does chemical reprocessing produce its own? Does it have its own set of concerns? Does that have to be? How carefully does that process have to be done or regulated?
Everything associated with nuclear power plants and nuclear power has to be done carefully. There's a lot of energy in this fuel. It requires a lot of care to handle coal or to handle natural gas or to handle oil. Refineries are not easy places to work. Chemical processing plants aren't an easy place to work. We handle a lot of toxic chemicals in various situations, fertilizer plants, plastics factories, all kinds of things. So when people talk about, yes, there will be some amount of care. There will be some amount of careful design. But we've chemically reprocessed used nuclear fuel ever since we started. In the early days, we didn't have a whole lot of it around. And we were doing a lot of experimentation, particularly out in Idaho. We built about 51 different power plants. And most of those fuels were recycled. The French had been recycling fuel for many years. We used to have a great recycling facility at Savannah River Plant. Very good performance at that facility. I've talked to the guy that designed and operated that plant for about 30 years or was involved in that. It's not terribly difficult. Yes, it costs a little money. Recycling anything costs some money.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the French, which leads me to my question. The French energy model, nearly four-fifths of their energy is supplied by nuclear. What are they doing over there that we, the United States, should be emulating? Is there anything that they're doing with their nuclear program that we should be striving to avoid? What's your take on it?
Well, first of all, it's four-fifths of their electricity.
Okay.
Like anybody else,
my
they
mistake.
Still burn oil in their cars.
Mm-hmm.
But the French made a decision, and they stuck to it. They built plants. They built them steadily. They only stopped building when they not only could supply four-fifths of their own electricity, but they also export approximately six plants' worth of electricity to their neighbors, Italy, Spain, and the UK. I think Belgium also gets some power from France, and Germany does as well. So that's when they stopped building. They stopped building in the mid-1990s after essentially building out their entire country with nuclear. And by the way, building out their entire country with emission-free power. It only took them about 20 years to do that. They've paused, they redesigned, they have a new reactor plant that they are building, the first-of-a-kind unit in Finland and the second-of-a-kind in Flamanville in France. And those EPRs are not starting off perfect. No construction project starts off and the first one is right on the way out. There's a lot of learning to be done. There's a lot of experience to be gained. And when you haven't done something, and in Finland they hadn't built a plant in 20 years, there's going to be some challenges. Doing something that's going to last for 60 years is hard work. There's no doubt about it. Some folks on the anti-nuclear side, guys like Amory Lovins or Carl Grossman or Arjun Makajani or Harvey Wasserman, they say, man, we got to go the fastest way. We've got this huge crisis, and we've got to go fast. Well, hey, we didn't get this way. We didn't get to our energy situation overnight, and we're not going to cure it overnight. It's like, you know, going to somebody who's obese and say, hey, you better go on a crash diet. Well, a crash diet's probably not going to work right. You know, trying to shift our energy system away from fossil fuels without using the best tool available is silly.
As far as opinion polls in France go concerning waste disposal, do you have any input to offer on that?
Opinion polls of France about waste disposal? I do know that the French have all of their used nuclear fuel going to a single place at La Hague. Most of it is stored underneath the floor of an accessible location. once they've done their recycling, people walk on it. You know, it's not very big. It's maybe the size of a high school gymnasium. I don't think they have a huge issue. I'm not sure what folks like. I think it was Makajani was talking about all of the releases to the English Channel. But the English Channel just off La Hague is accessible. It's testable. Yes, there's some measurable radioactivity, but radioactivity is measurable at some of the lowest levels around. That's why it's used in medical diagnostics, because you can add very tiny amounts and still track them, because they send out little homing beacons called emissions, you know, radioactive emissions.
Using that, touching on that point about nuclear as it relates to the medical industry, nuclear medicine, it's an interesting, it does bring up an interesting point where we, I guess many people, myself included, we tend to think of nuclear energy just in terms of power plants and energy and what have you, but there's also the issue of our health to think about. Do you feel that that point needs to be made, that point needs to be made more often as well?
Well, people certainly need to be reminded of the importance of nuclear medicine. There are some great treatments that are made accessible because of the use of radioactive materials, not just in diagnostics, but in actual cancer treatments. Radiation does cure cancer as well as cause cancer if you have excessive doses. On the other hand, there's other places where radiation is used very effectively and very importantly in industrial and in exploration where people don't even think about it. There's things called loggers, I believe, that are associated with oil exploration. They actually use neutron sources to go down and measure what the layers of the rock and the various hydrocarbons are as they're drilling, and it makes oil drilling much more productive. There are measuring devices in factories where they're producing vast quantities of plastic sheet or newsprint or thin parts for cars, and these measuring devices allow them to measure things. There's ways to sterilize materials. Most of the medical instruments in the country, in the world, are sterilized using radioactive sterilizers, and then there's the equipment's packaged up so that no bugs ever get in. There are many approved uses for irradiation for food, where you can get rid of the, or much reduce, not get rid of, but vastly reduce the chances of getting E. coli or salmonella contamination.
Mm-hmm. Also, just as far as other energy sources that nuclear opponents tend to bring up, solar, wind, hydroelectric, and what have you, you yourself are not opposed to those. I understand it's just that nuclear should be on the table. Is that correct?
Well, it's hard for someone to be opposed to a natural force like the sun or the wind. I like using the wind. I've been a sailor for most of my life. I've spent quite a few, more than most, hours being powered by the wind. I've probably got a couple thousand ocean miles under my belt. One of the things that you'll learn, though, as a sailor, particularly as a sailor, I spent some time racing and watching the gauges very carefully and going from puff to puff and getting excited about, you know, the next puff of wind. One of the things you learn about as a sailor is the wind is never predictable, and it's not constant, and it is never there when you really want it. I spent many more hours off the coast than most. The wind doesn't always blow offshore. I've been on the ocean where you could water ski for days at a time, and I can't imagine what it would be like to power an industrial, civilized society on the wind. Solar, great stuff when the sun's out, but we have this thing called night. We have clouds. We have dust. We have bird poop. We have all kinds of things interfere with collecting solar energy. I'm kind of an environmentalist. I really like the environment. I don't want to see it spoiled by having 40-story towers on the top of my mountains. I don't want to see deserts being covered by mirrors. particularly when I know that the next sandstorm is going to scratch those mirrors. And the next sandstorm after that is going to scratch the mirrors again. And pretty soon, those huge, expensive mirrors are not going to be as valuable as people thought they were. I don't like the idea of having to build transmission lines from all the remote areas. You know, South Dakota could power the country. South Dakota is a long way from where people are. How are you going to get the power from South Dakota or from the deserts in the Southwest to where the people are? You know, most of the people live east of the Mississippi River. It's a long darn way to put a transmission line up. I'm pretty familiar with transmission lines. That's what Dad did for a living. He used to take us on vacation and show us transmission lines and transmission substations. He even took family pictures next to the transmission substations. You know, those are pretty big, rather ugly devices. He thought they were beautiful, but I thought they were kind of ugly. But, you know, transmission lines take up a lot of space. And when you build a transmission line, you don't let trees grow up underneath it anymore, right? You put herbicides down. You keep the area clear so that the transmission lines don't get interfered with by growing vegetation. No, I'm not a fan of using large-scale wind or solar. I think it's a dumb way to invest our money.
As far as just you mentioned plants. As far as whoa, sorry about that. I hate that thing. Plants are built. If I understand you correctly, nuclear plants are built to operate for a specific amount of time. I think you mentioned 60 years in one example. Is that correct?
Nuclear plants are engineered to last for a very long time. Do we know exactly how long that is? No. The nuclear plants that we have operating in the U.S. today, about a little bit more than half of them have been relicensed after a very intensive regulatory inspection and review for another 20 years. They were initially licensed for 40 years, but that 40 years was not the design period. The designers didn't know how long they would last because they were still building things that weren't operating yet. But the designers put a lot of margins for safety in there, and the regulators said, you know, we've got to put a limit on this. What's the logical limit? At that time, hydroelectric dams were the closest thing that they knew of. So they said, well, we licensed dams for 40 years. We'll license reactors for 40 years and make them come back to us and show us whether or not we should let them continue to operate, just like we do with dams.
Mm-hmm.
But the 40-year period was arbitrary. It was not a design period.
That number was just plucked from – it was just made by
– Well, like I said, that was the period that the regulators were familiar with. They were familiar with regulating hydroelectric dams and saying, well, we need to reinspect the dams every 40 years. We'll apply that same period to reactors because that's what we know. Sort of like the old saw about why are the railroad tracks the size they are, because, well, you had to put two horses together, and so the railroad tracks are about as wide as two horses' butt.
During the relicensing process, on average, how long does such a process take for a plant?
The relicensing, I think they've got it down to where it takes about 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
I think the first one took probably 5 or 6. The first one that was relicensed was the Calvert Cliffs reactors, which are about 40 or 50 miles south of where I live.
And built into this, I don't know, but is it built into the relicensing process in some way, shape, or form that a plant has to have newer technology if it's to be relicensed again? Is that part of the agreement or no?
The plant has to meet standards. It doesn't have to necessarily replace equipment. In many cases, certain parts of the plant have been replaced already. Most of the plants in the U.S. that are pressurized water reactors will have already replaced their steam generators before they go to a relicensing period. Steam generators tend to last about 25, 30 years. No, you don't have to update the equipment because the plant is meeting the standards. And by the way, it's meeting really good emission standards.
For new reactors to be built in this country when they are being constructed, what is the what's the most common design that would be put forth today?
The company that seems to have the inside track on the larger share of the market right now is Westinghouse, actually owned by Toshiba and Shaw Group. I think something on the order of 60% of the announced projects involve Westinghouse AP1000s. And the AP1000 has a design certification, but the design certification that was issued for it was kind of a partial certification because it was not done with the digital instrumentation and control system. Because of the speed with which that technology evolves, the company didn't want to fix a design on that before there were people ready to buy. So they're finishing up the certification. Now, I just read that certification's been delayed until the final certification will be sometime around 2010. But there are plants on order today. Four of them have been ordered, I think two by Progress Energy and two by Southern Company. And so one of your interviews you pointed me to either is obsolete because of when it was conducted or the person just doesn't know. But there are engineering construction procurement license contracts that have already been signed.
Mm-hmm. With pebble bed reactors, and I understand thorium is thorium being considered for fuel, or has it been used already?
Thorium's been used before.
Okay.
One of the more interesting plants that I like to tell people about was the last core of the Shippingport reactor, which was the first large reactor built in the U.S., built as a combination of electric power plant and test device. But the last core of the Shippingport reactor had a very interesting fuel configuration called the light water breeder reactor. And by combining thorium with U-233, which is what thorium turns into when it's irradiated by neutrons, and redesigning the core to tightly pack the metal in the core, Admiral Rickover and his folks were able to produce a core that operated for about 5 years, 62% of the time. And the reason it was 62 is because it did a lot of testing. And at the end of that period, they tested the fuel and found out there was more fissile material after 5 years of operation than when they first started.
So this, I'm sorry, you were going to say?
So thorium's been used. The Indians have been very interested in thorium because they have some of the world's most rich thorium supplies. Although the U.S. has got some great thorium supplies. There's one area in Idaho, I think, that has a huge deposit of thorium. Pebble bed reactors? I love pebble bed reactors. The Adams atomic engine is based on a pebble bed design for the heat source.
Mm-hmm. I was actually going to ask you if those designs were similar. I know the specifics of it, but that's just from appearances. That's what it seemed to be. Just for the purposes of the documentary, could you just explain exactly what a pebble bed reactor does, how it operates?
Sure. Light water reactors heat up water and either directly create steam or use the water under high pressure to heat up steam in a secondary loop. There have been people that have talked about the fact that steam is not the only heat transfer fluid that we know of. We use a lot of gases in internal combustion engine and jet engines to turn turbines that don't have any water associated with them. You can cool down a reactor, or I should say transfer heat from the reactor into a working fluid with the fluid being gas. But in order to do that, most of the time you have to have something else that will moderate the neutrons. In a pebble bed reactor, the fuel element contains both fuel and moderator in the form of graphite. And the fuel balls look like this.
When James and I were talking, we were on Skype video. That's why I could describe things by saying it looks like this. He could see me. You can't. Too bad.
Can you see that?
Yes. Okay.
I'll hold it up against my white shirt.
Okay.
Okay, it's about the size of a billiard ball, and mm-hmm. This is actually a demonstration. It doesn't have any fuel in it,
But this is a pebble that was is the size that is used in the pebble-fed reactors. And they you can build a reactor of all kinds of different sizes. It's essentially becomes a bucket of balls. Okay, there's some control mechanisms and some flow things and some structural parts of the reactor, but essentially you just put balls into a hopper. And when you have enough of these balls together, they'll get hot. And if you fill a bucket full of balls, there's always empty space. Somewhere around 41% of the space will be empty, so you can flow a gas through there. If the balls are hot, you put the gas in, the gas gets hot. If you keep the gas under some pressure and you heat it up, you have an energetic gas that can be used to turn a turbine. And so the cycle that's most thought about with pebble-fed reactors is a, or that I like to think about, I should say, is a direct cycle where you compress a gas, you heat the gas, you expand the gas, you cool the gas. And while you're expanding the gas, you're spinning a turbine that can be attached to a generator. You can also just flow the gas through the reactor and then put that gas through something that looks like a steam generator. It, you know, a big heat transfer device where you put water on one side and the gas is in there and it turns the water into steam. Obviously, the gas stays in tubes and the water, you know, expands out. So the Chinese are building pebble bed reactors that are hooked to steam generating units and steam plants. The South Africans, with their pebble bed modular reactor, wanted to build a direct cycle gas turbine. I believe that one of the challenges that they had was that they chose a very difficult gas to work with from a mechanical point of view. Helium is what they chose, which looks great from the point of view of a nuclear scientist or from a chemist. But when you start to try to build a machine that uses helium, you run into some physical barriers. Helium's a very small gas. It leaks really easily. It has a very high speed of sound. It requires very tiny blades and narrow clearances. And you can do it. Don't get me wrong. Building a helium turbine is physically possible. But the South Africans found out it was a lot more expensive than they thought. So they're apparently going to redesign their pebble bed reactor to be a heat source for a steam plant.
Working out the kinks aside, pebble bed reactors, I guess, among other designs, does this, from your perspective, seem to be where the future of nuclear technology is heading?
It is one of the futures. For my point of view, the people who try to put boundaries around fission is like trying to put boundaries around fire. Fission creates heat. There's a whole lot of ways to do it. Various specific applications may find certain designs better than others. One of the things that I haven't talked much about is I don't like the idea of only building very large central station nuclear power plants. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of energy demands that come in smaller packages. The 1,000-megawatt nuclear power plants that we have today are completely unsuitable for certain applications like driving a ship or powering an island or even supplying a country as large as Ireland, because Ireland's only got about 4,000 megawatts on its whole grid. And you don't want to have one-fourth of your grid be supplied by one plant. You want to have a little bit more diversity than that, somewhat smaller plants. The country of Jordan is very interested in building nuclear power plants. But the whole country of Jordan only averages about 1,000 megawatts of electricity. Their peak load is only 2,500 megawatts. So building a 1,000-megawatt plant would be unbalanced there if they want to keep the electricity in Jordan. Now, if they're going to be suppliers for the whole region, that may be a different story. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a need for diversity.
Just going back, just to talk a little bit about nuclear incidents that are cited often by nuclear opponents in this country. There's Three Mile Island. If you go abroad, Chernobyl often comes up. The Fermi reactor in Monroe, Michigan in 1966. There was a book written about it. We almost lost Detroit. I'm just picking a few examples here, but what can we what argument are the when the nuclear opponents make these points and point out to these what argument needs to be heard, I guess, from the proponents who want to talk about why these are kind of examples that are set apart? What is it that makes these situations unique, and how should our fears be allayed? I realize it's kind of long-winded, but okay.
One of the responses that I have is, you didn't just give a random sample of the accidents. I think you only missed one, the wind scale accident.
Okay.
Maybe two, because you didn't mention SL1.
SL1,
okay. Other than that, you can name, and most people can, they can name all of the nuclear accidents that we've had. Accidents. Now, there's a whole bunch of incidents, but incidents happen all the time. You know, sometimes what gets reported as an incident in a nuclear power plant is about the same scale as spilling some gasoline at a gas station. But the accidents you can name on a hand with an extra finger. Now, let me turn it the other way. Can you name me the last five fatal natural gas accidents?
Not offhand,
sir. How about the last five fatal oil accidents? And I guarantee you that every one of those has taken place within the last year. Now, those are the competition to me. How many people die in coal mines every year in China? Over 5,000. How many people die in coal mines in the U.S.? Not so many. A couple of dozen every year. Natural gas. We just had a natural gas explosion here in my town the other day that caused far more injuries than Three Mile Island did.
Annapolis?
No, it was in Baltimore, I think.
Okay.
There was a gas leak at a strip mall. Firefighters went and reported, and they couldn't get the gas cut off, and I think 12 firefighters and a few bystanders got hurt. Actually, the number was 8 firefighters and 1 Washington Gas Company employee. There'll be a link in the show notes. There was a natural gas explosion in Carlsbad, New Mexico, that had a huge impact. It actually, I believe, was one of the major causes of the energy crisis of the 2000-2001, because it occurred in August of 2000. It reduced the supply of natural gas into California by a third, and it killed, very painfully, 12 innocent people who were simply camping in the desert. They happened to be there when the pipeline exploded and caused a huge crater to be issued. How many people have heard of that? Not very many. On December 23rd, 2003, there was a natural gas well in a remote area of China that went out of control. It was what's called a sour gas well. It had hydrogen sulfide and a few other nasty chemicals that were being released, and they lost control of that. Normally that stuff gets pumped back into the ground. You know, we handle sour gas all the time. But this sour gas release killed almost instantly over 200 people and put 9,000 people in the hospital. It was on the page 4 or 5 on the 24th, and by the 25th it was out of the news. One of the reasons that people know so much about nuclear accidents is people keep repeating and repeating. But the other reason is because it's quarter like a man bites dog versus dog bites man. Which one is news? It's not news when there's somebody gets burned by fossil fuel. Happens all the time.
It is largely a matter of perception then by the public, and maybe things that don't get covered. Nuclear enjoys a unique status, I guess you could say, among accidents. Fossil fuel incidents are shorted on coverage then, in your opinion.
I think that people get reminded about nuclear accidents. There's a lot of people who have a professional interest in discouraging the use of nuclear power. Even folks who believe that they're completely independent, like Carl Grossman, he wrote a book in the 1970s, and as he described in the interview that you did with him, he's been on the college lecture circuit ever since. I bet you he doesn't do it for free. On the other hand, the energy market is the world's largest industry. It was the first multinational industry. It's based on fossil fuels. In 1942, there was absolutely no knowledge by anybody that a controlled, self-sustaining fission reaction could be done. There were a few people that thought it could be done. They hadn't proved it yet. December 2nd, they proved it. By 1957, people were going to sea on submarines powered by nuclear power. Nautilus reported underway on nuclear power January 17th, 1955. By 1990, the U.S. had as much power being produced in nuclear power plants as the entire grid produced in 1960. There were people that weren't real happy about losing their market share as nuclear kept expanding. You know, what was the power source in France before they started building all those nuclear power plants? Who was selling the fuel? How much money did they lose when France kept building nuclear power plants? And France is only one country. You know, France has 58, the world has 400 and something. If we had just kept building at the same rate we achieved before the anti-nuclear industry got involved, we wouldn't be burning coal in the United States today.
You refer to it as the anti-nuclear industry. So your contention is there's a swath of people that make a comfortable living, in your opinion, talking against nuclear energy. Do these people make any, as shrill as the points may be, in your opinion, do these people make valid points every now and then, even though they may be stopped clocks, in your opinion? Surely they have to be right at least twice a day, no?
Well, I think that they're right on some things, sure. For example, I've been trying to discourage the nuclear industry from getting involved with the government's decree for Yucca Mountain for over 10 years. I think Yucca was the least beneficial location to put used nuclear fuel. It is as far away from the operating nuclear power plants in the U.S. as you can make it. Okay, if you draw a loci of all the power plants in the U.S. and you say, if we want to put a facility that maximizes the total distance that the fuel has to travel, where would we put it? And the area near Las Vegas, Nevada, is probably pretty close to that max. As a former manufacturer, I like to minimize the amount of time and effort I spend moving stuff around, particularly when it's not productive moving around. That's one problem with Yucca Mountain. The other problem is the stuff's not waste. It's resources for the future. Why would you send it to the most inhospitable location you can find, especially if you plan on recycling it someday? Who's going to man the recycling facility out in the middle of the desert? I just got back from a vacation out in that area of Nevada and Utah. Beautiful place. I mean, nice place to hike and visit as long as you're just visiting. Horrible place to live, 60 miles northwest of Nevada.
Oops, meant to say 60 miles north of Las Vegas, Nevada.
Geographically, Yucca Mountain's a bad bet, in your opinion. But are there other factors involved that make it that make it not the best choice, in your opinion?
Well, I've been convinced by some pretty sharp people that for a very long-term storage solution, you want to have a reducing environment versus an oxidizing environment, and that makes sense to me. I spend a lot of time in oxidizing environments on the ocean. With metal ships and metal and oxidation, eventually the metal rusts. It goes away. It crumbles. But there are places where metal never rusts because there's a reducing environment from a chemical point of view. Metal likes to stay metal in those places. So it would be better to put the storage devices in a reducing environment. Again, it just doesn't make sense to me to move it as far away as you can. We have, by the way, an operating storage location for radioactive material that's working great and has plenty of space for lots more. But it was initially licensed and sold to the public in New Mexico as only a pilot project. They call it the Waste Isolation Pilot Project. And it stores a lot of defense waste, stuff left over from the bomb programs and whatever. And it's in a salt cavern. I think I've noticed that you've read Gwyneth Craven's book called The Power to Save the World.
I'm still in the middle of it, but yes, yeah.
She talks about the Waste Isolation Pilot Project. And this place has, it's 2,000 feet deep in a place where it's just complete salt caverns. And they can put in a new storage location, put the material in, and it just self-seals itself up. And no water ever gets into a salt cavern. If there was water there, it'd be dissolved away, okay? But, you know, we have places already. I like just leaving the stuff where it is. Why bother to spend the money to transport it? At this point, we took a quick break for a film change.
Yeah, standardization of nuclear power plants. As far as just the construction of the plants, the design of the plants, is that was that something that we might have missed the boat on? Is that something that we need to change as far as just constructing a certain type of plants so that this way we can kind of minimize problems along the line? Or what's your stance on that?
I'm in favor of standardization within diversity. In other words, there's no doubt we've known since Eli Whitney that the way to make an economical product is to build the same thing with interchangeable parts and build it repeatedly. What I'm not in favor of is somebody trying to decree that all plants have to be a certain design. I like the idea of having enough different sizes, different technologies, different choices that all market segments that can benefit can be accessed. And I don't have any problem. As a matter of fact, I like competition. But I think that the vendors have learned their lesson. Westinghouse, once they make some sales of the AP1000 or Areva with its EPR or, Hitachi, GE Hitachi with their ABWR, ESBWR, they're going to build that same plant over and over again. I've listened a lot to Mike Wallace, who is the head or is high up in the Constellation Unistar Areva area, and he likes to talk about a fleet of plants. And I know where Mike Wallace got the term because he's a retired naval officer, but they want to build the plants so that if a reactor operator leaves Flamanville, where there's an EPR, and he flies over to Calvert Cliffs where there's an EPR, or he goes out to Texas where there's an EPR, he'll walk into the plant and think he's back in his home. The bathrooms will be in the same place. Everything will have the same color paint. You know, there'll be one standard EPR, and that's a smart way to go. But I don't think that every nuclear plant has to be the same design.
Mm-hmm. So a good portion of the competition with construction of new plants will come from what design somebody feels would work best, depending on geography or any number of factors. Am I understanding that correctly?
Sure. Well, the EPR, for example, is a slightly larger plant. It's about 1,600 megawatts compared to the 1,100 megawatts or so for the AP1000. The ESBWR uses boiling water technology. Some people like that better. There are some advantages of boiling water, some disadvantages. There's also a Mitsubishi design, which is going to be the biggest. It's about 1,700 to 1,800 megawatts. So there are some economies. If you can get those plants built effectively, you may be able to make a little more money if you can sell a little more power. Again, eventually, Adams Atomic Engines hopefully will become a phoenix and rise from its sleepiness. And we want to build plants that are more on the order of 10 to 50 megawatts in size, which we think could power villages or small towns. I live in Annapolis, Maryland, population of about 40,000 people. It would only take about 100 megawatts to power the whole town. I'd like to do that with five or so Adams Atomic Engines.
So small-scale nuclear, in your opinion, small-scale nuclear technology, I should say, is something that's on the horizon. Are there other designs, including your own, that are making some noise at the moment?
Oh, sure. There's a company called Hyperion, which has a well-publicized and very intriguing design for, mm-hmm. They call it a nuclear battery. I call it more like a nuclear furnace. It's a heat source, about 75 megawatt heat source that is about the size of a large hot tub. And then they surround it with concrete and bury it underground. Can be transported on the back of a truck and then fueled on site. Very intriguing design. You still have to connect a steam plant to it if you want electricity. But if you want heat, that's pretty good. And there are places like the oil sands out in Alberta, Canada, or other places where a heat source is what you really want more than an electricity source. There's a company called NuScale. And NuScale is a very intriguing design because it's about a 45-megawatt electric natural circulation reactor. Uses light water technology, so the fuel rods for the NuScale are essentially the same as the fuel rods that are being produced today, only shorter. So they can leverage off some economies of scale. They may have an easier time getting licensed because the regulators are very familiar with light water reactor technology. And like regulators everywhere, they're pretty conservative and like to approve what they know. Our design is going to be a little harder to license only because the regulators have very little experience with gas-cooled reactors. Let's see. There's Toshiba's got a very nice little design for a sodium-cooled reactor called the 4S. I think it stands for Simple, Safe, Secure, something else. I can't remember what it is. But they want to build that 10-megawatt reactor in a place called Galena, Alaska, initially. But they're out marketing pretty aggressively to other places where power is hard to come by. You know, the world is only about maybe a third to a half electrified right now. There's a whole lot of people in Africa and India and South America that have no access at all to electricity. They'd like some. And so if you have small plants that don't need a fuel train, don't need a fuel supply situation, that's a good thing. And the Toshiba reactor is designed to last for about 30 years without refueling.
Harvey Wasserman, he brought up a point that nuclear reactors release heat into the environment in the form of, you're talking about the steam. Okay. As far as that goes, what is the impact of that, if any, to your knowledge?
None.
Okay.
The amount of heat that's released is calculable, and it's far smaller than what the sun insulation is. I mean, it's orders of magnitude, many orders of magnitude smaller than what the sun brings down to us. Every power plant releases heat. There's mm-hmm. waste heat in the heat engine because the heat engine works from going from hot to cold, and there's always a transfer of heat. There's always heat that has to be released. Steam plants are nothing new. Nuclear steam plants release heat just like coal-fired steam plants, just like gas-fired steam plants. Jet engines release heat. It doesn't make any sense to me for him to talk about that release of heat as something that builds up. All of the heat that's released from all of the cars and trains and airplanes and power plants and all that, it doesn't mean a hill of beans compared to what the sun brings down and then can't escape because of the buildup of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases.
I believe Grossman made this point as well, but Mr. Wasserman says that the steam that escapes is irradiated in the process somehow. Can you speak to that? As well as the water, if you can just address that point. Thank you.
Right. The steam that comes out is not irradiated. It's the secondary steam. It is what cools the steam that comes from the turbine. No radiation involved in that. I don't know what Wasserman and Grossman were talking about when they talked about routine releases from reactors. Remember, I used to go to sea on a submarine. I was not only the engineer, but I was the atmospheric control officer and the safety officer. We monitored our atmosphere very carefully. We had very sensitive detectors on board. There is no routine releases of radiation from a nuclear power plant. There's no routine releases of anything. The steam that's coming out is just water vapor.
Just going back to the point about small-scale nuclear energy, with the waste disposal problems that we the waste disposal procedures that we have with the plants at the moment, how does that change with the advent of small-scale nuclear energy? What's the same? What's different?
Well, with small-scale nuclear energy, the supplier is going to make arrangements to recover the used nuclear fuel at the time that it needs to be recovered. Mm-hmm. It'll still be valuable, and it needs to be, you know, the small-scale reactors are not going to have all of their own fuel handling equipment. they'll be treated more like the way you overhaul a ship. You bring it into a yard, and there's a specialized crew that takes care of it. Or the way that you take care of a refinery. There's not maintenance guys there all the time. The maintenance guys come in on a schedule, and they take care of the maintenance, and then they leave. And that's the way the small-scale reactor is going to be. There'll be a crew that'll go. It'll get the fuel. It'll have specialized equipment, and it'll bring it back to a central location. Okay, but it won't have to be done very often. Again, the Toshiba reactor is going to be designed to last for 30 years without new fuel. The Hyperion reactor, I think, is like 8 to 10 years. We're thinking about initially 5 years because that works well with the cycle of ship overhaul, and that's kind of the market that we're most interested in. Because when you talk about small-scale nuclear for a ship, you don't have to compete against cheap coal or cheap natural gas. The only other power source, the only other fuel source that ships have is distilled oil, distillate fuel. And distillate fuel is not cheap. You know, it got really expensive. And those guys are running baseload power plants on distillate fuel. There's not too many people around the world that run baseload power plants on distillate fuel. And so they have a real problem. And we think that a smart way to introduce any product is to find the early adopters, find the people that really need what you can do better. And we can offer two things to a commercial ship. They don't have to carry as much fuel, which means they can carry more of the revenue-generating stuff that they're designed to carry. And we think that we can reduce their fuel costs. And, oh, by the way, we can also help them meet the emission requirements that they're going to have to meet here shortly.
Mm-hmm. And as far as when small-scale nuclear technology, how small a scale can we anticipate in the next 10 or 20 years or so? Is the idea of a nuclear car, is that a pipe dream, or is that something achievable in the near future?
Nuclear cars are pipe dreams.
Okay.
You're not going to get that small.
Okay.
When I talk about small, I use a number that sounds really small compared to 1,000 megawatts. I say 10 megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 10 million watts. Okay, 10 megawatts. That's the same size as 14,000 horsepower. That's not a real tiny machine.
No.
You know, it'll be about the size of, you know, a single-family house. It's not something that's going to be movable once it's installed. And, again, as I mentioned, you know, the city of Annapolis, it's a capital city of a state, about 40,000 population. It would need 10 megawatt power plants, which is about the same number, you know, a far smaller number than the number of gasoline stations. It's not something that would be a large number of these devices running around. They're relatively controlled. They'll be protected like you protect the local bank. You know, there'll be security involved and some very careful engineering. But 10 megawatts can produce $8 to $20 million worth of revenue every year, depending on where you are. That's a pretty good income stream.
Mm-hmm. And this technology, as it starts to grow, that's where a lot of competition will start to come in, which I would imagine, which kind of brings me to my next point. When the interview with Dr. Makajani criticizing nuclear energy, where he talks about how Wall Street is the prospect of nuclear energy made or has made Wall Street a little bit antsy. Dr. Patrick Moore says that a lot of regulatory burdens have been compounded over the years, which have made nuclear energy unprofitable. I guess there's kind of a conflict of ideas there, but just to give us a little clarity, where's the as far as just competition in the marketplace? What does the free market have to say about nuclear power?
There are many folks that are investing a lot of money in nuclear power today. Most of them aren't on Wall Street. They're folks like Warren Buffett. They're folks like the French people that run Areva and Electricity de France. They're German electric companies like E.ON and RWE. There's Italian electricity company ENEL, Total, the petroleum company, Centrica, a British gas company. In the U.S., Northrop Grumman, Newport News, and Areva have partnered up to build a facility to build large pressure vessels near the Northrop Grumman, Newport News shipbuilding. Shaw Group is heavily investing in nuclear power. There's an awful lot of folks that are putting an awful lot of money, about $4 to $5 billion a year right now, before we start construction, is flowing into new nuclear building capacity and that kind of infrastructure. Babcock and Wilcox has recovered their age-old name. They finally got out from underneath the BWXT name, and they're investing a lot. They've got an N-stamp back. There's a guy out in Texas who's very quiet named George Chapman. He's formed his own company called Amarillo Power, and I still believe that George Chapman's got an inside track to be one of the first new nuclear power plants built in the U.S. because he's a rich man. He's a billionaire in his own right, and he doesn't have a big board of directors to answer to. There's all kinds of folks that are recognized in the potential. I've talked to an awful lot of investors. You might imagine, as a guy who's tried to be an entrepreneur, I've made a lot of presentations, and there certainly are problems to attract financing. One of the problems is Wall Street's got a short attention span. Wall Street investors want to make their money in 3 to 7 years max. That's their time horizon. It takes time to build a nuclear plant, and it takes time to recover the money that you invest in it. But if you build something that's going to last for 60 years, you need to have some patient money. You need to have some folks that have a longer time horizon than that. You know, I'm not a real big fan of some of the investment choices that Wall Street bankers have made over the last 20 years or so. They bought into a lot of stuff that was crap. Okay, it was get rich quick, get the bankers rich quick. You know, places where they could skim their profits off their salaries, their bonuses, regardless of whether it made money. I mean, if I remember correctly, Makajani talked about Standard & Poor and kept quoting them as some sort of oracle. Well, please correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Standard & Poor give some pretty high ratings to things that are now completely underwater called derivatives and collateralized debt obligations and a bunch of other things that Wall Street invested in? You know, talk about the losses at Whoops, which were a few billion dollars, completely different scale than having a, you know, AIG, which, you know, a Wall Street investment company that I think the U.S. taxpayers already put $140 billion into that place. I love it when the anti-nukes keep pointing, hey, Wall Street doesn't like it. Well, Wall Street's a bunch of, well, never mind.
Fair enough. Just to address another anti-nuclear, a nuclear opponent point, the issue of Three Mile Island. From the interviews I've conducted, Three Mile Island seems to be the point where the anti-nuclear movement sort of coalesced. That's kind of where they, I guess, got a good portion of their energy, their drive, the No Nukes concert, and what have you. You were around at the time, I imagine. Do you remember what the tenor of the times was? Can you speak to that in any way?
Well, I'm pretty old. I was in college in 1979.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I was. It was not too long after 1979 that I had my interview with Admiral Rickover. It was, so I was pretty well aware of what happened at Three Mile Island. I've had a lot of friends associated with it. A good friend of mine, her father, was a 3-star admiral who was hired by General Public Utilities to go and run the cleanup. So I've had the chance to talk to Frank on a number of occasions. It was a coalescing point for the nuclear industry as well. Mm. Three Mile Island reminded people that, you know, we were involved in something very serious, and you had to do things the right way, and you had to do an awful lot of training and lessons learned and paying attention. But we also look at Three Mile Island and say, yes, what that reminded us is that there's not too much difference between a $2 billion asset and a $1 billion liability if people make mistakes. And there were a lot of mistakes made at Three Mile Island. There were one of the things that happened there that when I was a chief engineer officer on a submarine, we trained very carefully and actually memorized a portion of what's called the steam tables. At Three Mile Island, one of the big things that happened was that the operators didn't recognize that their plant had reached what's called the saturation point. The water was no longer under excessive pressure. It was at the same temperature and pressure where it boils. And so they should have recognized that when the water level went up in the steam generator at saturation pressure, that meant that there was a bubble being formed. They should have recognized that. They should not have turned off their cooling pumps. But another thing that happened at Three Mile Island was the plant did melt down.
More accurately, the reactor core melted down.
It did. More than 60% of the fuel melted to the bottom of the pressure vessel. So we did the accident that Grossman likes to imagine. We have the results. And the results are that massive pool of molten fuel went down and it touched a very thick metal barrier and froze. It solidified again. It didn't penetrate that massive, thick metal pressure vessel barrier, which is the first layer, by the way. You got the pressure vessel, you got all the foundation underneath the pressure vessel, you got the containment. So it hit the bottom of the pressure vessel, and it penetrated the bottom of the pressure vessel less than a fraction of an inch, about an eighth of an inch. Okay, so this fantasy that somehow a meltdown is going to penetrate a pressure vessel, penetrate the foundations of the plant, penetrate into the containment, go down and hit the water table and explode into a massive burst of energy that releases all the radiation all at once is, again, a fantasy. It's not going to happen. Metal doesn't work that way. You had something hot, it hit something cold, heat transfer occurs, the hot stuff gets colder, the cold stuff gets hotter, and it didn't melt. Okay? The steel didn't melt. And so we've done the accident. We've got the test results. We can show you. This whole fantasy, you know, when I was being trained, we used to have people that would say, well, what happens if your whole core vaporizes all at once? My answer as a practical guy is, if you can tell me how it's going to vaporize, then I'll do the calculations. Otherwise, don't waste my time. I'll talk to you about the things that can happen that physically have some possibilities. I'm not saying nuclear power doesn't have accidents. I'm not saying that nuclear power is something, you know, violates, you know, the reality that it works with human beings and human beings make mistakes. We will have problems. We will have incidents. We will have leaks. You got, you know, pressures, fluids, and all that stuff. You can have leaks. But the consequences of our accidents are arguably and provably less than the consequences of the accidents for most of the competition. Now, I grant you that a single windmill probably can't do a whole lot of damage, but it can kill people. You know, falling is one of the highest sources of accidents in any industrial activity, and 40-story towers are pretty easy to fall from. Windmills can break. There's all kinds of dramatic videos available on the web with blades falling off, and when you got a 100-meter-long blade, it can go and hurt somebody. Probably if it hits you on the head, it'll kill you. But nuclear power is pretty darn safe, has a lot of layers of protection. I feel very safe with nuclear power. I try to encourage my daughters to become nukes. Didn't succeed there, but at least I got a son-in-law who's a nuke.
What was that something that with your son-in-law, what did the convincing process, how did that go?
I didn't really have to convince him much. He's a pretty sharp guy, but he is a submarine officer.
Okay. And what stumbling block did you run into with your daughters, if I may ask?
My daughter told me, well, Dad, if they'll let me go on a submarine, I'll be a nuke. But since they tell me, my daughter's also a naval officer. Mm. Since in the Navy, that's the one place where women can't go, she said, I'm not really interested in being on an aircraft carrier and being in the hole.
See. As far as just getting back to Three Mile Island for the moment, there was talks about, well, this is from people who oppose nuclear energy. The opponents say there was talk of cancer rates going up in the area. Conflicting with that is the NRC report that I heard. I think Penn and Teller did an episode with that show Bullshit. I think they covered that, and they cited the NRC report saying that the amount
that is a good video, by the way.
Okay, the amount of radiation released in the area was roughly equivalent to an X-ray. Nuclear opponents say that cancer rates are in fact present in the area. There was talk of lawsuits. I don't know if you can speak to any of that, but I guess my question is, who do we trust here?
Well, I know who I trust, but okay. There was an awful lot of lawsuits. They went to the courts. The courts made a decision based on a lot of evidence. The judge, who actually has an interesting name, Judge Rambo, she threw out
Rambo,
the case,
yeah.
said there was no support. She tried to give it every benefit of the doubt she could. The area of in Pennsylvania where Three Mile Island happened has been an industrial area for a long time. It was a coal-producing area. They had steel mills. They had chemical plants. There's a coal plant just down the river from Three Mile Island, which happened to run a lot more than it would have if Three Mile Island would have kept running. So, you know, there's one guy, you know, one epidemiologist from North Carolina, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, who everybody points to. And
is
said,
that
hey,
Dr.
He
Wing?
Said, Wing, yeah, Dr. Wing. He says that there's higher cancer. If you read the Wing study, he assumed that there had to be more releases than there were, because and so it's not very well done. He assumed away a lot of things and said, well, if this much was released, then maybe we can find something. So read that study. It's not particularly convincing, and there's an awful lot of other studies out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of a Democratic kind of guy, and the majority of the people who are knowledgeable about this area say nobody was killed. There was very little that was released. Most of it was noble gases, inert gases that have very low ability to affect anybody. They don't stick in your lungs. Yes, there was some curies released. Was it more than you get from an airplane trip across the country or normal background dose of radiation? You know, I don't think so. And neither does anybody else who's studied the matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you listen to anti-nukes, somehow all of the detectors, the plume must have been really smart and kind of weaved its way around and made sure it didn't touch any of the detectors, and it stayed all concentrated and finally found a person and laid on top of them.
As far
dilution does work.
Just to go back a little bit in time to the Fermi reactor, the 1966 incident, would you be able to shed a little light on that, exactly what happened?
No.
Okay. All right.
I think I've studied, but I can't remember any details.
All right. That's fine. I guess moving forward then to Chernobyl, another incident that's often cited by people discussing nuclear energy. What went wrong exactly at Chernobyl, and why is that the sort of thing that can't happen here? If you could just explain.
Okay, and this is going to be the last question. I realize it's getting to about 8:30, and haven't had dinner yet.
No problem. We're about to shut down after that, too.
Okay, good. Chernobyl was a reactor that could be operated safely. There have been a number of those RBMKs that have been operated safely. The Ignalina reactor, for example, in Lithuania is still operating today. Unfortunately, the people in Lithuania are being forced to shut down their primary source of electricity because people still think that it was just a design problem at Chernobyl. Chernobyl has a design that can be operated safely with trained operators and with good quality control and with good protection systems. The Soviets didn't do it terribly badly. They even operated some of the Chernobyl reactors while they were cleaning up the one they blew up for a number of years. But at Chernobyl, at the reactor that blew up, there was a political operative and some experimental folks who said, we need to do an experiment and we've been told that this experiment has to be conducted, and we're going to ignore every safety rule we know. We're going to turn off all of our safety devices, and we're going to tell the operators, it doesn't matter that you're getting indications that confuse you. You're not going to stop this test. We're going to keep pushing you to get this test completed. I don't know if somebody's going to get a bonus. I don't know why they had to do it. They did it on the back shift. You never do things on a back shift. And eventually, they put the plant in exactly the wrong condition with the wrong power history to where their control rods became an accelerator. Instead of the control rod inserting poison into the reactor and slowing it down, they had a situation where pushing the water out of the way as the control rod went in actually added reactivity and caused the reactor to blow up. It was a graphite moderator reactor, so once the reactor blew up and the water came out, there was air coming in and very hot graphite, and air and hot graphite turned into a smoldering fire that lasted for a while and was hard to put out. There were about 30 people on site who were killed either right away or very soon from radiation and heat and burns and those kind of things. Firefighters mostly, early responders, plant operators. Over the next few years, there have been another dozen or so that have died of injuries or illnesses that can be directly traced to exposures they got at Chernobyl. The total death toll right now stands at about 50, according to the World Health Organization, for an accident that occurred more than 20 years ago. The World Health Organization study says as many as 4,000 people may eventually die early from cancer associated with the releases from Chernobyl. Now remember, this core burned for several days, releasing a lot of radioactivity to the environment. And some of the pieces of the core got dumped around the area. When the World Health Organization statistically says as many as 4,000 people may die, they didn't say 4,000 people will die. They said there's a chance of that. Mm-hmm. And who knows what other health effects were caused by the mass displacements, the evacuations, the stress of leaving your home behind, being evacuated, being told that you're a victim, being told that if you're a victim, you get paid. I don't know. Sometimes you have a little bit of incentive to say, hey, I don't feel so good. But the fact of the matter is the area where Chernobyl blew up is now one of the most interesting wildlife preserves, not because the animals are all mutated, but because the animals are living in an environment where there's very few human beings around. There are some, by the way. And the area has reverted to a forest-type area that's unheard of in that area of Europe for the last couple hundred years. I've got a book called Wormwood Forest, written by a Ukrainian-American who went to Chernobyl and as a reporter and got so fascinated with seeing what she was seeing and she went back for several visits to the Chernobyl forest area and she's a biologist and fascinated by wildlife, and the book's great. I highly recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember who wrote it. I'm trying to look at my bookshelf over there, but so the Chernobyl accident has often been used, quite honestly, it's been used by many people who are in the nuclear industry.
Mm-hmm.
To say, hey, our reactors are a lot better than those. You know, ours are, replace all those reactors in Eastern Europe with our reactors. Or in some cases in the EU, they say, we're going to shut down all those Eastern European, Russian-built reactors, force those countries like Bulgaria and I can't remember who else had to shut down their reactors before they could join the EU. Well, there were people that got to replace those reactors. Somebody made a big sale when those reactors got replaced. If they got replaced by natural gas, somebody's making continuous sales. Because instead of producing electric power with uranium, they're burning natural gas. Well, natural gas is a big business. The more sales you have, the more money you make. And by the way, when I mentioned professional anti-nukes, most of the folks that make the most money from opposition nuclear power, they never talk about it. It's the guys who are selling the replacement fuel. You know, one plant, a couple of $1 million a day worth of fuel, that adds up after a while. You can slow down the development and retain a market for coal. U.S. burns about 1 billion tons of coal a year at $40, $50 a ton. If we had just kept building the plants we were building, the coal industry in the U.S. would have gone under. We wouldn't have needed to burn coal in power plants anymore, and that's the only place we burn it. Just imagine. It's not just the coal industry. Got the railroad industry. 40% of the rail traffic in the U.S. moves coal.
Well, you said that was the final question. Was there anything else that you wanted to, anything that you wanted to add or address, or any criticisms made by the anti-nuclear side that you wanted to just clear the air of before we say goodbye?
Clear the air, so to speak.
Maybe the bad choice of words.
All I want to say is if you're really serious about cleaning the air, cleaning the water, you need to learn more about nuclear power. And, you know, Grossman denigrated everybody who is a professional as if we're, you know, just trying to protect our jobs. Well, I chose this profession. I don't want to sound vain, but I'm a reasonably smart guy, National Merit Scholar, top of my class in high school, you know, went to the Naval Academy, did well at the Naval Academy. I've learned lots of things. My master's degree is in systems technology for computers. I could work almost any place. And I haven't been employed by the nuclear industry yet. As a matter of fact, I still make a living by serving my country. I'm still a professional naval officer. I like the technology because I know about the technology. I've studied it. I've met the people who are responsible for the plants. Some of the best, brightest, hardest working folks you can imagine are in the nuclear industry. Some very family-oriented folks live very close to the plants. They raise their families there. They want their children to go work in the plants. Now, these people aren't brainwashed. They aren't dumb. They're really bright. Some of them are pretty quiet, both because they're engineers or because they come out of the silent service. Not all of us have the gift of gab. Not all of us want to go and make our money on the college lecture circuit fighting against something that we think is pretty good. And some of them don't want to spend a lot of time trying to explain to people who aren't willing to take the time themselves. Nukes sometimes are a little vain. They're a little bit cocky about what they know, and they don't always share it very well. Some are getting really good at it, though. There's some really good pro-nuclear blogs out there, some pro-nuclear podcasts. John Wheeler does a great job. With This Week in Nuclear, you know, go over and read Dan Yerman's Idaho Samizdat blog. Go over and read Energy from Thorium. We talked about thorium a little bit. Mm-hmm. And my friend Kirk Sorensen, he and Charles Martin are really excited about thorium.
Sorensen, yes, I've heard his name.
Thorium's a great fuel source, but, man, there's nothing wrong with uranium. We got plenty of it. We got a whole bunch of it sitting around the U.S. already mined that just needs to be converted so that it can be, you know, used in a power plant. So, but there's some great information sources out there. So my advice to anybody who is concerned is learn. Don't just listen to folks that make a living or have, you know, invested their entire credibility in being opposed to nuclear power.
Mm-hmm. We certainly appreciate your time, Mr. Adams. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you've listened all the way through, you win an award for patience and stick-to-itness. So remember, if you are very concerned about clean energy, talk to your representative, your representative's office, call your senator, write letters, and tell them that if we're going to have a clean energy development agency, that it cannot exclude nuclear power, the most scalable, most reliable, and arguably least environmental impact power source available. Have a great week, and I'll try to put out a few more shows with a little more regularity as time moves on. Take care. Thanks for listening.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.